Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. We spend a lot of time talking about how important it is to take care of your mental health. Therapy is an excellent way to do that. BetterHelp is an affordable mental health care option that fits right into your busy schedule. Just answer a few quick questions about your needs and preferences, and BetterHelp will match you with one of the thousands of experienced mental health professionals in their network. You can talk to your therapist over text, chat, phone, or video. You get to pick what works best for you, your comfort, and your schedule. If you feel like your therapist isn't the right fit, BetterHelp makes it easy to switch to someone new at no additional cost. So give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. BetterHelp is offering our listeners 10% off their first month of therapy. Just go to betterhelp.com/musicspeaks to get started. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/musicspeaks to get 10% off your first month of therapy.
Like so many of you, we battle depression during life's many ups and downs.
Music has always been there to help us through the tough times that we all face.
Follow us on our journey as we discuss the healing power of music.
Interview artists and bands.
Break down genres and music news.
Review artist biographies.
And much, much more.
You're listening to the When Words Fail Music Speaks podcast.
Hey, everybody. This is... back up. I messed up. Yes. All right. Hey, everybody, this is When Words Fail Music Speaks Podcast with your handicapped host, James Andrew Cox, JAC. And I'm here with two of my past guests from recent episodes. I got Benny from Music Circus and George Agen from The Agency. George reached out to me. He emailed me before he came on and said, I love what y'all talked about with Music Circus, Benny. And when after we did the episode, we're like, I'm gonna try to get Benny on for you so y'all can meet him. So this is the first time ever two musicians from my podcast that I've interviewed are meeting for the first time.
So dangerous.
I'm not sure if I should make this like an alchemy episode or so, I don't know. So we got Benny and George. So welcome, guys.
We'll make
maybe
you proud.
Maybe we'll behave. I don't know.
Right? Drama. I guess you don't have to behave. So we know we can just talk about stuff. But first of all, I want to know what y'all are doing because George, I told you your episode came out this morning. So and you're back from Chicago, correct?
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you doing anything like fun?
I'm doing what all singer-songwriters do, which is working as a graphic designer, video editor, photographer, social media guru, marketing manager, booking agent. Benny, am I leaving anything out of things that we have to do as singer-songwriters?
I don't do any of that stuff. So I respect the hustle.
Yeah.
My Instagram is blank. There's not a single post on it. I always think like, you know what? Next month. Next year, I'll start that stuff, and I just don't.
Yeah.
You did cultivate an interest in being on podcasts, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, so I'm being silly. George. I respect the hustle, but I assume that's not what you were doing in the Congo. So
I need to have a regular job that pays for all of these all of this time in the studio and all of this stuff that I'm trying to do. Music-wise, here we are. But like you, I said, all right, you know, the next step is I want to be on some music-oriented podcast. Mm. And I came across James's podcast, and I happened to listen to the episode that you were on. Mm. And I was like, oh, my God, this is like, I'm almost like I'm listening to myself, because he talked a lot about the set of EPs dedicated to your late dad and... Mm. And how, and then you went into some detail about how, you know, I'm not a sad person by nature. And, you know, the contrast between not being someone who's, you know, looks like a person who would make sad music, yet making sad music. And I heard that, and it's like the tagline in my bio is, why do happy people make sad music? So when I heard you talking about that stuff, I'm like, wow, okay. So I'm not the only one who's cognizant of this. And then you went on and talked about doing covers And you mentioned people who do reharmonization covers. And for listeners who aren't familiar, reharmonization covers, like when you take, generally speaking, reharmonization is when you change the chords of a song. But a common way to do it is to take a song that's in a major key, for example, and move it to a minor key. And so you mentioned some artists that are doing that. And then you mentioned a cover that you liked, which was Brad Meldow, the jazz pianist, cover of Blackbird.
Blackbird,
yeah. Beatles' White Album. Yeah. And I was blown away because the song that I'm in the middle of promoting right now is my own version of Blackbird, which is a reharmonization of
which
the
I
song.
To. Yeah.
So I'm like, this is crazy. The guy has kind of the same approach to songwriting in terms of the emotional aspect, but then he's talking about reharmonization and then, you know, a Beatles fan and talking about, you know, Blackbird as an example of how to do that. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And we talked about it on the episode when I spoke to James previously. And and then, of course, he had the idea, said, well, you know, why don't the two of you get together? And so thank you, James, for facilitating all that. Great.
Sure. It's funny. It's like sometimes the best reharmonizations are so subtle, but they're not subtle in the way that you'd imagine. Subtle sort of implies that very little from the original has been changed.
Right.
But in fact, that's not the kind of subtlety I mean. I mean the kind of subtlety where the melody still shines through and it feels very different, but you're not quite sure if it's different.
Right, right.
And then you have to be like, oh yeah, this is very different.
Right.
But it doesn't strike you like that because you're so taken by the things that haven't changed and the sort of emotional stir is different somehow.
Yes. Well, I mean, the fact that you use the word subtlety, I think, is so appropriate because let's be honest, reharmonization, especially parallel key reharmonization, it's a cliche now, you know? There's whole YouTube channels dedicated to what would Happy Birthday sound like in a minor key and that kind of stuff. And I think we're 6 months out from one click of a button, AI creating a reharmonization of any song that you ask.
Well, but you seem to have like a feeling about that. Like what?
Well,
tell
yeah,
me,
because I mean, like, when you
yeah,
get to
tell
the
me,
whole...
tell me your feeling about that, and I'll tell you why you're wrong.
I think, well, from the AI angle, all right, we're still human, right? We're doing something creative. It has to be something that reflects how we feel about it, or some kind of inspiration, and not just an exercise. So, as a songwriter, as an arranger, I don't want to do an. I could do it just as an exercise. But I'm not putting out anything that I would do just as an exercise unless I really felt that it was, as you would say, something subtle in there where, yes, I'm reinterpreting this song. And it really, if you want to get into the music theory of it and all of that, that's great. But even if you don't, you just hear it and say, that's the same yet different. I like that. And not a kind of a sledgehammer. Here we go. This is Happy Birthday in a minor key. Ha ha ha.
Sure. I mean, thing is, most reharmonizations, well, okay, let's do just genre. That's an easy one, right? Sure. You take a song that's not jazz and you jazz it up. Like, what does that mean? Most people who listen, they go, wow, this sounds really jazzy, but they don't know what the adjective jazzy means.
Right.
For those of you listening who may or may not know, usually when you reharmonize something into being jazz, other than the rhythmic aspect, you're taking a certain kind of chord or class of chord, which is usually called the dominant chord, and you're beefing it up tremendously with lots of different kinds of tense notes around it. And that makes it jazzy. I mean, I'm sure a music theorist might have like a more nuanced or subtle way to say it, but you literally
get all of his critiques of what you're saying.
You literally jazz it up. Like you're jazzing something up, right? You're adding notes to it. You're like, you're making it sound jazzy. That kind of reharmonization has a place, but it's not nearly as interesting as the more subtle approaches where normally the chord progression repeats four times, but you actually change the chord progression on the third and the fourth time, or you change the way that it resolves that it's subtle. It doesn't jump out at you. It's just sort of like, oh, there's something kind of nice and interesting about what's happening here.
Yeah.
So, but I don't think that if you think back in music theory land, most of that stuff was settled in like the 1800s, turn of the century, maybe. And then when jazz came around, those were most jazz standards are reharmonizations of show tunes or something else.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So it's like, that doesn't concern me even a little bit that everything is like a click of a button. Because if you think about the way most people in the past were raised with music, they could reharmonize on the fly anyway. And that was, you didn't even have to push a button.
Right.
Right.
You could just be like, now it's in a minor key. And like, wow, right. Cool. But I liked it in a major. Okay, now it's in a major key. Right. Or like any good accompanist would be like, oh, you want to do it a third up? Okay, here it is a third up. Oh, you want to do it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I personally, I don't see the artist as the center of the reharmonization in the way that you framed it.
Interesting.
I see the listener and the intrigue in refreshing their ear in a way as the sort of center of a reharmonization, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So like what you put your stamp on Blackbird and you're drawing the listener into a version of it that they literally will never hear anywhere. You're not imitating what was already there,
right?
Because that's easy to do.
Right.
You're saying, well, if you do it this way, it's different.
Right.
And this is the way that I've arranged it. And plus with something like Blackbird, especially on an acoustic guitar, you have all the other elements of the open strings that you're leveraging,
right,
which is really cool. So for the listeners, if you look at a guitar, people think of guitars as like a guitar. It's kind of like a miniature harp in a way that you can like move the notes around, so it's very strum oriented. But it's very limited in the number of strings, only six. So the way guitar sounds a lot like guitar is the specific order the strings are laid out and the specific way the hand is shaped and leveraging open strings, so not plucking any notes because they have a lot of resonance. And that tends to be where guitar, especially the acoustic guitar, really like
of course
sounds beautiful.
Yes.
Because you're introducing notes that maybe aren't always totally logical, but they resonate so beautifully.
Yeah.
Because it's a guitar. And that really is where reharmonizations shine. And then not to make too much of a, sorry, I'm like dominating the conversation.
No,
to make too many bridges back to too many things previous, but we were talking about Brad Meldow's version of Blackbird, which is very beautiful. And I think it's common knowledge, but one of the unique aspects of Brad Meldow's playing is that he seems to evoke guitar style voicings where he's playing as if there are open strings on the piano, which in piano, it doesn't exist in that way.
Right.
So you have these voicings that are very guitar-like, but obviously in a piano context. And it's very beautiful. And a lot of his reharmonizations, I actually went and saw Brad Meldow 2.5 weeks ago play live.
Wow.
It was amazing. And he played Blackbird.
Right.
He does other guitar-oriented pieces too. Like, are you familiar with the work of Elliot Smith?
No.
Portland.
I think he's
originally from Portland. Fantastic singer-songwriter. He passed away many years ago, but he's excellent. And he has some beautiful pieces that Brad Meldow also performed.
Okay.
And again, like it's that open string interaction
right.
type voicings that really make it come to life.
George,
anyway, I would say that you're refreshing the listener in a way when you do a reharmonization that's subtle. When it's not subtle, you're jazzing things up in a way.
Yeah.
So George, speaking about the acoustic part with this song, you got Lawrence Juber to play on this song with you, correct?
Yes.
And he is, correct me if I'm wrong, but he played for Paul McCartney, correct?
He was a member of Wings from
1982.
So he was a bandmate of Paul McCartney.
Nice.
So what happened was I had worked out the arrangement note for note. I'm not a great guitar player, but I was able to sit there and figure it out and get all the voicings that I wanted on the guitar. And to your point, Benny, it was tricky because, as you said, Blackbird is known for that open G that's always there.
Yeah.
That voice is always there. But when you're reharmonizing it to G minor, you don't really have as much flexibility to use the open string. So that was a challenge. So anyway, I had worked out this arrangement, but it was, you know, I'm not technically a great player. And so I thought, if I'm going to do this justice, I need someone else to play it. So I work closely with Fernando Perdomo, who's an amazing session guitarist based out of LA area. And so I brought it to him and he said, listen, I think this would be better in the hands of Lawrence Juber, because Lawrence Juber, aside from having played with Paul McCartney in Wings, which is already lovely, you're doing such a classic Paul McCartney authored song, to have somebody who was actually in a band with him play it, said, but Lawrence Juber, who they call LJ, is kind of considered the guy for Beatles fingerstyle arrangements, like covers of Beatles songs done in a kind of instrumental acoustic guitar way. And so he said, you know, he knew Lawrence personally, so he just immediately sent an email saying, meet George. He's got this really interesting arrangement of Blackbird. I think you would be even better at playing it than me. You know, guys, go make magic happen. And that's what we did, which was, you know, I'm still kind of pinching myself. Like, you're one step away from the legends that nurtured you, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that's what's amazing about, we can complain about the music industry the way that it is today, but in a way, the playing field's been leveled that, you know, regular people have access to such amazing people and musicians that have shaped them and shaped the whole conversation for decades. And I'm still kind of in awe of that. It's wonderful.
It's cool. Yeah, I always think about the records that we grew up listening to. Maybe the early 70s is a little bit far in the past, but if you look about the 80s and 90s stuff, you probably could make a record with a lot of those producers if they had the time and the budget was there.
Yes.
If you wanted to.
Yeah.
If you were so inclined.
No, you can't. Okay, maybe not the superstars, but I mean, you take a guy like Kenny Aronoff, right?
Sure.
Who's like John Mellencamp can't really go nowhere without his grooves. I mean, anybody can hire him. I mean, he's probably a bit more expensive than your bog standard session drummer, right?
Yeah.
He's probably more than $500 a day, but he's not that expensive. And he's, I mean, because the industry has changed and those guys can't command the fees that they used to. And so legendary drummers like him from the 80s and 90s are available to lots of people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. I mean, it's cool. I always think about, I know that this is like a very businessy way of thinking, but I sometimes think about what you get when you're the best in the world at something. Like, everyone agrees you're the best in the world at something. And it's interesting to understand the hierarchy of those things. And I think I'll give you an example. If you are absolutely hands down the best buy-side analyst for mid-market companies, you get paid $5 to $12 million a year. You work at Goldman Sachs, you work at it. And if that happens to be the thing that's really, you're really good at, even better if you're really passionate about it and you enjoy it, like, you end up commanding millions and millions of dollars. If you're the really, like, the best guy in something that's like very market oriented. But at the end of the day, if you're the best at rock drums, like, what is the ceiling just is relatively low, especially if you didn't end up in the biggest band in the world or something. If you're Lars Ulrich, like, okay, fine, like, you're in Metallica, it's a little bit different. But if you're just like a really, really great session guy, you just, there's sort of like a maximum, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, but it is sort of like being, you know, absolutely the best chess player in the world. You can probably make millions of dollars a year and win tournaments. The best checkers player in the world, like, I don't know how. Like, I'm not.
No one plays checkers anymore, right? It's all about chess
or whatever it is. You know, it's like, are you the best at basketball? Well, okay. Are you the best at stacking cups, like that weird game that people play? Like, there's just like such a difference, you know?
Right.
So, but I was thinking, I think you're right in a certain sense that the internet has made it possible for even the best guys in the world to decide a fee and do a home setup that makes it possible for you to hire them for a session.
Yeah.
Right.
And maybe 20 or 30 years ago, either the infrastructure wasn't there. So even if they wanted to,
right,
it was really hard to hire them, even if their rates were the same. And now
right,
there's all these platforms like Sound Better and stuff like that, where you could absolutely literally just be like, can you play in this? And I'm like, sure.
Mm.
And it's like, can I use your name to promote it? And they'll be like, no.
It's like, that's right.
I've had that discussion before. And you know, then the idea, also the idea of feature and all of that. But I think a lot of that came, and that's how I got into all of this was, and probably James, we talked about this when we had our first conversation, was mm-hmm. pandemic times when, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly the sales of gear went through the roof and everybody decided to pick up their old guitar and, you know, get better at something they always talked about doing because they had plenty of time. And I started doing that as well, but also then realizing, wait a second, if I'm stuck at home, then all the greatest musicians in the world are also stuck at home.
Right.
And so then you had, you know, the likes of Fiverr and Sound Better, as you're saying, Benny, and suddenly all these connections started to happen.
It's cool.
I mean, it's brilliant.
What's your pace now in terms of making music? How do you bring it together?
Well, right now, current situation for the past few months and probably for the next coming month, creating is pretty much down to zero, which probably is not very wise. But I just spent so much time and effort in the studio over the past 3 years that I've got a backlog of things that I need to get out and promote. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm doing it, like you said, I'm hustling, you know, I'm doing the way they say the waterfall strategy and spend 6 to 8 weeks promoting a song and then package it as an album at the, you know, after you've done promoted six or
seven. Well, I hear your voice. You're doing the voice that people do when they don't really want to do it. Or they're annoyed by it.
We're all trying.
Well, no, like, listen, yeah. It's it's annoying. It is annoying.
Yes.
I'm not going to lie and say I love, you know, making these, thinking of crazy ideas to do micro content every day to slog along this process. But I do believe that there is a reason for it. And I mean, you start to see results. Okay, you start to go from putting it out a short and you get 500 views on YouTube and then it maxes out. And now, because I've put more stuff out there, now I'm getting to 1,000 or 1,200. And so, you know, you start to see that consistent, sustained promotion. And, you know, sooner or later, I mean, all the YouTubers have talked about this, is that they make videos for years and years and years sometimes, and it goes nowhere and they think it's a total waste of time. And then, you know, they become the overnight success story that took X number of years, right? So I do believe in the process. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. You know, there's other things I could be doing with my time. But I can't say I'm in love with the idea of, like I joked in the beginning sarcastically, being all of these things, of, you know, a video editor and. You know, I would rather just be writing more music or arranging more music or recording more music. But right now I feel like I'm in a phase where I got to put out the stuff that I've worked on and give it a shot.
That's cool. Do you feel like, do you really trust the process?
I trust that I'm going to try it for this year and see how it goes with this first set of singles. Yeah. And if I find that, you know, I really gave it an honest try and it didn't produce any results, maybe for the next album, I would do it differently. Mm. So I'm not, you know, we're not little kids anymore, right? So we're not full of all this idealism and thinking that everything's going to go great the first time you do something. And so, you know, life experience has taught us that, you know, there's going to be mistakes and there's going to be disappointments. And so I figured I'm going to try it. I don't have all the answers. I don't think that because I love the music that I made that suddenly it's going to work out great for me. That's usually not how life works. And if you do get lucky in life on the first try, you probably end up setting yourself up for a lot of disappointment. Because when you go for try two and three and four, you find out that actually you just got lucky the first time. So it's not that I don't believe in it. I do believe that it's worth pursuing. And I will reserve judgment when I have spent enough time on it.
So it's funny because go on. Sorry, James. No, it's okay.
Okay. So let me ask you a question, because so the podcast business is kind of like being a musician with all the promotion and everything.
Yeah.
A lot of times I think that to myself that this is like a thankless job. 20 views here, 70 views there. What do each of your outlooks look like, as opposed to like? Do you think that this is a really thankless job sometimes, and it gets better gradually, or do you like think that this is like a total, like it could be a lot better than where you are now? And I'm
That's
gonna
a
let
tricky question.
I'm gonna let Benny go first, if you don't mind, George.
It's tricky. It's because I think that there's a romance around being an artist or being a creator that doesn't match or really like fit with the reality of life and the world. So an example of what I mean is like very, it's very simple, where there is an abundance of excellent players of all instruments out there. There's so many, in fact, and there are more and more being birthed and sort of pushed into the world on a daily basis. And there really isn't just enough eyeballs and support for all of those players in most contexts. And an example of this would be like if you have a friend who studied, I don't know, let's say anthropology or something, and they graduate 100,000 PhDs in anthropology a year, and there's 200 open university, full-time university positions for it. You sort of end up with like a lot of adjunct professors out there, right? Like, so I think that you have like a lot of adjunct musicians out there. There's just a hyperabundance of them, and there's sort of not enough ears to absorb or ears to listen to the music, et cetera. So then you end up in this sort of desperate feeling of like, I need to cut through the noise and I need to attract attention to myself, which all that stuff's fine. But at the end of the day, if you want to be making music, you should be making music. And you should enjoy whatever you can about making music. And if it's supposed to be a means to an end, it's probably the wrong thing. And if you take this on the flip side, very, very, very few, and you can email me if you hear this and you don't believe what I say, very few, maybe 3 out of 10 lawyers are just like, I love the law. That's why I'm here.
Yeah, 3 out of 10, right.
My lawyer seems to love the law. He's great. He always excited about talking about legal stuff. But most lawyers at a certain point, they just are like, well, this is a job. Like, this is hard, but I don't really love the law in that way. But you can really love the music and have absolutely no desire to be heard, really, or not even record, you know? So the thing I respect about what you're talking about, George, is you're trying to bring it all the way through to connecting with fans. Because part of your artistry happens to be that you don't want to make music quietly in your room alone. You don't want to put it on a tape and listen to yourself, put on a CD and listen to yourself in the car or something. You want to see if there are fans on the other side, and you're doing the things that you know people do in order to reach fans on the other side. So I think that in reality, I always say this to people and people don't. I give lots of advice that is totally terrible and no one should follow.
Oh, no, go home,
But
man.
I think a lot about scale of things and how there's a really big difference between one listener and 1,000 listeners. It's a really big difference. It's 1,000 times. And even 1,000 to 10,000, that's just not that much of a difference to me. That's, you know, but that's 10 times. So I think that there is sort of a, what you call like a hedonic treadmill happening, which is like, well, if you get 1,000 plays, like 1,000, well, it should be 10,000. You get a 10,000 plays, like 10,000, it should be 100,000. You get to 100,000 plays, like, what's 100,000? It should be 1,000,000. And then you talk to I have, you know, friends who have million plays on songs, and they're just like, well, million's not really anything. It's like not even,
not
it's
anymore,
like nothing really. Yeah. So then it's like, now you get to 100 million, it's sort of a different.
That's a big deal. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a much bigger deal.
Rare.
But anyway, so I think that if you don't really have a love of the game, probably not worth doing it.
Right.
And if connecting with fans is an important element of your feeling of making it real, then you should be pursuing listeners.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And I go back and forth. I go back and forth and being like, I want people to hear this, to being like, eh, it's actually okay if they're just
totally hear that. So like, if I had answered the question first, I would have said it's not tricky at all. I'm doing this for me. And I argue about this with other songwriters when they're like, well, no, who did you write the song for? Like, nobody's, the song is written for me.
Yeah.
If it's dedicated to somebody, and James, we talked about this, you know, whether, you know, songs that I wrote about my kids that are dedicated to them. I didn't write it for them. I wrote it for me to process the love that I have for them, or the feelings that I have for them, or whatever that happens to be. Okay. So when you're 16 and you pick up a guitar and, you know, this girl you have a crush on, you write a song for her, you know, maybe you're not mature enough to understand what's really going on there, but with age and a little bit of wisdom, you realize, no, that's for me to process. And for that reason alone, it's worth doing. Now, me having it on a demo tape from 1996 and, you know, listening to it is different than now, 30 years later, going and saying, hey, you know what? I want to do this properly with professional musicians and with the right kind of mixing and mastering and all that stuff, and print it on a CD, and I can say, I made this. So that's, you know, and okay. So that's, so the first part is to create it for yourself, for the emotional aspect of what it delivers for you. The second part is to realize it in a consumable form for yourself, for the sense of accomplishment. And then the third bit is to be able to share it with others. So yes, I'm investing time to share it with others because music has brought me so much joy in my life and comfort. And like, what's, you come back to, you know, what are we doing here? What are we leaving behind? You know, we're at the age where, you know, I've seen people who have come and gone before their time, and you think, okay, yeah, the super analyst on the sell side who's making $5 million a year, and you know, and then what? He won the video game. He has the most money, right? But then what? What do you leave behind? And to me, when you make art, and in our case, music, you live forever, and I love that. I love the whole idea of that. And so that motivates me to keep going. Not because I'm looking for fans and looking for fame. That's, you know, we're not silly teenagers. I mean, that's silly. Although, frankly, yeah, it's lovely when you get comments and people say, I love this arrangement, or that's a great song, or, you know, I'm subscribed because I like the sound of your voice, or whatever it is. Yes, of course that feels good. Not because someone is flattering you, but because, hey, I touched someone with a piece of my soul, with something that I created from me. And that's wonderful. And I love that. And it's getting to 100 million. To get to 100 would be enough for me.
I think that we really are children. And when when you meet a 5-year-old or 6-year-old and they're eating a pack of Welch's gummies.
Right.
And then they take those sticky, disgusting, dirty fingers and they pluck one out and they hold it out to you, stranger, to give it to you.
Right.
We applaud it. They're being pro-social. They're engaging with the world around them. They're being generous. They're being, and I think that that is essentially how I think about music stuff too.
Okay.
Because you don't have to play it for anyone. You could just play it alone, and that's totally fine. You can just, I don't know these people, so I'm going to take the packet of Welch's and I'm going to slip it in my pocket. I'm just going to pretend like I don't have anything to share, and that's fine. You know? So I don't see, I think that there's something about the world that tends to sort of cast you like, oh, you're a narcissist. You want people to see you. You want this or that and the other thing. I don't think that 5-year-old is really thinking, I want this random middle-aged man that I don't know to like me. I think just we're humans and we do pro-social things. And
yes. Totally agree.
It's just fine to be. Yeah. And music itself is a pro-social thing.
It is.
Yeah. It's a social thing. It's supposed to be. Yeah. I still have yet to figure out what and how and why to do the like daily content thing. Yeah. It just never really made sense to me. And I never really had the energy to do it. Yeah. But partially because I like to, these days I like to practice and I like to play by myself a lot. And if I think about making a video, it doesn't excite me nearly as much as
I'm sure it doesn't
noodling on the instrument. So, and I just don't, I've never been good at doing things I don't want to do. Now, like really don't want to do.
Since you brought up that topic, let me ask you, did you play all the instruments on those EPs?
So there, no. I mean,
you got horns and strings and stuff there. So, but like the core of it.
So I play strings. I play violin, viola. So I think all of the strings are done by me.
Okay.
Which, and all the arrangements are done by me. I tend to do almost all the basic tracks myself.
Okay.
And then I rely on really great session guys, just like you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, not for all of it. Sometimes the jangly stuff is usually done by me. But if there's something that really shines, and also there's real pedal steel on there done by a guy that I work with named Jack McLaughlin. There's excellent drumming. You know, I went to the Berklee College of Music. So, we got a intruder.
Oh, we do? Oh, okay. He's like, if I didn't see it. It's okay, though.
Now we're going to have to get a model release for your son.
Right, I got to have a waiver, you know, or something. Oh. Yeah.
But what I
sent an email warning, but evidently wasn't passed on.
Just the number of times. I actually have a funny story about this. When I was a little kid, I was like fighting with my brother and my dad was on the phone. And he hung, and I must have, I don't know how old I was, like under 10 years old. And it was old days with the wired phone, you know?
Right.
And he hung up the phone and he was so mad. And he turned to me, my brother, and he's like, I just left a message on like blah, blah, blah's answering machine. And I said, this is Alan. And then you yelled, fuck. And so it sounds like my name is Alan Ruben. And like, of course, my brother and I are like mortified. And so was my dad. But it's really funny. I thought that was really funny.
Alan, you know, in my day job, I work in political sphere, and sometimes I'm doing TV interviews, I was doing these remotely long before Zoom was even a thing. You know, so the idea of business up top and, you know, PJs on the bottom, like I've been doing that. Like that was like the thing in 2020. I'm like, dudes, I've been doing that since 2014. Like, you know, you're not new. But there was that famous one where some economics professor and then his kid on the little rollabout or whatever comes in the door, and then his wife is like, getting out of the bathroom,
snatches the kid up.
Right. And so many friends emailed me, George, I want this to happen to you. I want this to happen to you. This is the best
thing I've ever seen. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah.
No, you don't want that to happen.
No.
You don't want that to happen. It was like an expert on Korea or something. He was like talking about like a very serious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. Like so, you know, North I mean, Korea everybody knows this, the context of this thing. It was pretty famous.
Yeah. So we do have about like 5 or 10 minutes left, but I just wanted to talk about this one more thing with y'all, if you don't mind. Sure. Going back to the things this job thing. Okay. So, I used to focus really on numbers, and I've been told not to. And I'm sure you all did that when you first started your music journey, right? But as time grew on, 5 years now, I tend to care more about the people who actually get something from this podcast as opposed to numbers. Yes, I mean, 100 million is fine. That's what I aspire to want, you know, and get. But if somebody can go back and say, I got dollars from this podcast, from this episode, that's where I'm at, you know? Do you all think about the individual as opposed to like millions and millions of numbers right now, which I'm pretty sure y'all answered, but you know, just to.
Well, that's tricky. I actually think that's a tricky question. And the reason why it's a tricky question is that the sort of cliche would always be like, oh, it's quality over quantity.
Right.
But I actually have a sort of sneaking suspicion. And George, you can tell me if you think I'm off base here.
Okay.
I have a sneaking suspicion that something being good has more shareability. Mm-hmm. And when something really doesn't resonate, it doesn't grow that much in numbers. And it's very, very rare that I'll encounter something that is excellent and differentiated, you know, it's unique, that doesn't have a pretty substantial number of listens. And I'm not going to say what substantial means. You can imagine whether it's 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 or a million or whatever is sort of irrelevant. That usually scales based on the genre and how niche something is. So it's very rare that you find something you're just like, this is unbelievable. And it has like five listens, five views or something, right? So there's something about greatness that helps it move from person to person efficiently. That said, presumably you have to kickstart that process in some way. So you never quite know what kicked off something
and it's frustrating because my first album was entirely a cover. It was a mashup covers concept where I took songs that, you know, really had nothing to do with each other. I mean, King Crimson and Taylor Swift and mashed them up together, right? So there was seven tracks all with like, what the hell was this guy thinking type mashups. And so because they're covers, I thought, okay, well, this should be easy to promote. I'll go on Reddit and find all the subreddits about whoever these different bands and post the link. And well, I mean, if diehards of these bands are going to, you know, these are the diehard fans, surely they're going to listen to it and share it. And then find the Facebook groups associated with those bands and the Discords and guess what?
Nope. Right. It's like nothing.
It fell flat.
Yeah, right.
It fell flat. Now, so I don't take that personally. I'm not disappointed in that. I'm a little bit, but it's also surprising. This I guess is true for any artist. The ones that you favor are not necessarily the ones that other people are going to favor. The ones that you are most impressed by. Sure, you found this, Benny, when you look at your streams. Maybe there's not a direct correlation between the songs that you think are the most impactful and the ones that other people find the most impactful, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I think that this might be just a difference in personality, and I don't mean this to dissuade you in any way. This isn't meant to be a dissuasion style conversation. Uh-huh. I'm not trying to deprogram you, just FYI. Okay. You've excelled in the world of business for sure. The simple fact that you're in demand for whatever it is that you do means that you've succeeded to whatever degree you have. Maybe you're the most important person in your field, or maybe you're one of many experts in your field. But maybe you're one of many experts in your field that operate at a very high level.
Sure.
Both are absolutely great. In the world of business, most worlds of business, there really is a process that you succeed by. And usually that process is all the basics are there, meaning you can actually do the thing you're supposed to do. And if you have enough conversations with the people who are in a position to buy the product or service that you're selling, lo and behold, you succeed. Does that mean you become the next $100 million company? No. But there's sort of a natural process that sort of gets you there.
Yeah.
And I think for the most part, I would argue that that natural process still exists in live music.
Okay.
Bands that play a lot of shows. They play a lot of shows and a lot of shows and a lot of shows. Yeah. And every night they're connecting with 10 people, 20 people, 50 people, 100 people. And maybe they go to different cities and they have bands. And there's a lot of like motion happening, and something about that motion attracts enough motion that that there's sort of like a listening base. Yeah. I'm not convinced that the digital only mechanisms actually produce snow that sticks.
You're right. I don't think it does.
You understand what I mean?
I don't think it does at all.
So that's why, that's where it usually breaks down in my head, where I'm like, well, I can make content, and I can make content to reference my own content, like to point to my own content. And, but at the same time, I know that if I started a new ad agency, well, it's a very simple formula. It's a certain percentage of these are going to close unless you're a total bozo and you don't have the goods. Like, but if you do the meetings, you're going to build a business.
Well, I mean, if I was a good, you know, good student regurgitating what I've learned from all these social media gurus, okay, I would say
like, trust the algorithm.
Yes. Yeah. No, not just trust the algorithm, but sooner or later, somebody will see your content and say, I like that song, or I've heard that song. I've heard that clip of that song every day, or I've heard it three times in the past month. And he finally clicks over, he or she finally clicks over and goes to Spotify. If they like it enough and you've made all the content, that is therefore the fan. You know, when you funnel it down, you finally have all those streams and all those random things where people swiped away after 2 seconds or whatever. When you finally get a fan, they need to have something to latch onto.
Sure.
And if they do, and they become a fan of you or me, and then they end up watching this podcast episode with James, this is me and you, somebody whose music touched them in a way. Now they're listening to us as regular people talking. Fans love that stuff. And so that's where it becomes the substitute for the real life. The live thing. But that's not a direct path.
Yeah. Well, the indirectness, I think, is
to get there. And like I said, I'm going to try it for this year. I'm going to try this very circuitous route for this year and see how it goes.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, what else can you do? It's so funny, Jordan. You're so like well media trained.
You like say well, that's what I do for a living.
That's a job, right?
you say a complete thought, and then you have this like unsaid magical way of like handing it back, which like me, I'm like totally unmedia trained. I'm like jumping in.
You're actually really good, and that's an honest thing, because I have to say, James, and you know, because you've been doing interviews like this.
Yeah.
I watch some of these musicians, and I'm just like, wow, these guys need media training, because they're not organized. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, I have like 11 monthly listeners, and yet I'm getting podcast hosts interested. And I think it's probably just because even the way I write an email to them explaining who I am, they're like, okay, obviously this person knows how to communicate and will be, you know, have interesting things to say on a show. Maybe his music's not so interesting or not important or whatever. That's up to the listener. But again, this is a, you know, this is a game of, it's a social game, right?
So you have to
produce yourself in a certain way.
Now, can I ask one question, George? This is,
you can ask as many questions as you like.
This is, we're getting into artistic territory.
Okay.
Sometimes people like these questions, sometimes they don't. And when I first started to make music through this whole episode with my father getting sick and everything, I made like my first recordings and I shared it with my friend. And my friend was just like, I don't recognize you in this. Well, we talked about that, right? Because I was sad and I'm not a sad person. So you make sad music because you're in this sad state. And he was just like, this like doesn't have any of the Benny that I know in it. Okay. I don't like that very much, you know? You're not drawing influences from how many countries have you visited and worked in? 50, 60, 70?
A lot, yeah.
Right. So you're sort of like actively avoiding bringing in your own life experience, your emotional experience. I'm sure you're bringing in. You said you mentioned you wrote songs about, you know, your children and things like that.
Sure.
Obviously, those things are important. Do you ever feel like maybe the connection? And yes, this is me asking myself a question aimed at you. So do you ever think that maybe when you really let your whole being in to your music and you really start to draw the connections between your professional life, which is also your real life, and your music life, you might actually unlock something interesting, whether it's a resonance with fans or a new musical plane?
I think somehow I feel that I am doing that, and it's but it's not in an explicit way. It's an implicit way, because I think the, like James said last when we had this talk last time. I know we're running out of time, James. So I'm gonna
totally fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I spend a lot of time in very poor countries where, you know, the joke about first world problems is very, very real to me, because I see, you know, I see kids who are picking through the garbage and begging on the street every day. And then I come home to the US and it's like, give your pet the best gourmet dog food and get it delivered on Amazon Prime in 22 minutes. And if not, you know, call customer service and be caring about it. And it's like, okay, that's funny, me being sarcastic about it. But being aware of that has shaped my whole approach to the world. And music is also an expression of my approach to the world. It's something to share with people, to touch people, to bring comfort to people. And so, yeah, am I writing songs about what it's like to see poverty in Africa? No, not explicitly, but somehow I am.
Yeah.
Somehow I am.
Yeah.
And so I'm, you know, I feel comfortable with that. I feel comfortable with the music I'm making, reflecting who I am today. And, you know, who I will be 3 years from now, or 4 years from now, or 5 years from now, or whatever. We'll see what comes out. But I don't feel the pressure to let me talk about certain subjects, let me write about certain subjects. I mean, what is Mozart's 40th Symphony about? You know, or what is whatever about? I mean, you know, I remember going to see the Mozart Requiem with a close friend, and there was this one part where the strings are all in unison, and it's so slutty. It's like this chromatic do-do-do-do-do. And I'm like, that is so slutty. Like, no, this is the Requiem. This is about death and mourning. I'm like, this is not about death and mourning. This is about life. This is about living. And that line right there is bloody as hell. And so, you know, that's how I look at, you know, in my very, very modest way, you know, talking about Mozart and all of that. But yeah, every artist somehow indirectly channels everything they've seen in the world into what they do or should try to do.
Interesting.
Yeah. Nice.
That's cool.
Nice.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. Awesome. Meet you train right. Yeah. Awesome. So before we go, I do want to give each of you time to tell our listeners, you know, what's coming, what are we looking for, you know, I mean, are you planning on releasing anything new? And then I'll wrap the show. But I'm gonna
George,
let you...
how many tracks do you have stored up that you haven't released yet?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got the album I'm currently rolling out will have, I think, 10 or 11 tracks. I'm almost halfway through that. And then for 2026, I have another covers mashup concept that's based on Vivaldi's Four Seasons, in which each of the 12 moments of the Four Seasons is basically a backing track for a pop song that has similar harmonic or rhythmic structure.
Cool.
And then I have, similar to your project, the year after that is a kind of a concept album based on coming to terms with mortality. So I really enjoyed listening to your EPs, because I felt a lot of the same. Although it's much more poetic than what I did, I would love to talk to you privately, and because it's a very, very mature sound. I love even the sound effects, and some of the things you're doing there are really, really mature. That's the word that I just kept coming back to. I'm like, God, does my music sound this mature? This is really somebody who knows what he's doing. I really, really, really enjoy.
I'm happy to divulge all my secrets, open up my Logic files, and show you. Really, I'm not joking.
I would love that. I would love that. But yeah, so that's what I have in the pipeline.
Okay.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. That's why I'm not writing.
Did you mention
right
the word 2026?
You're right. Yeah.
Wow. 2026. George, is that a year? Does that exist?
Yeah, I guess so.
Actually, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was one of you gentlemen that told me you were gonna release a song every month, and then after December, y'all are coming out with the album.
That's what I'm doing right now.
Okay, yeah,
To Benny's earlier question, you know, is it worth it? Do you believe in all of this?
Right.
Well, I'm going to make that decision at the end of the year, because when I come out with, you know, when it comes to finishing all that, and it's like, well, then it's the Four Seasons project. Because that's a concept, I could just say, okay, here's the album. I'm not going to go through all the tra-la-la of releasing one track every 6 weeks or whatever. Here's the album if I don't feel like doing it again. So yeah, I'm keeping my mind open to that.
Yeah, nice. Cool. Benny,
my 10th EP from the Muted Circus Project. It's just sitting.
I haven't decided when to pull the trigger on releasing
okay,
it.
Okay, I was wondering about that soon. Because I kept counting. I'm like, am I counting wrong? Why do I only see nine here?
Right, yeah. Yeah,
the 10th and final one I haven't
okay
released. Just whenever I feel like it.
Whenever
all five tracks.
It happens when it happens,
everything's
right?
Done, all the parts are done?
Yeah. Yeah, it's already mixed and mastered. It's
oh,
been
wow.
Like
okay.
Years. But yeah, it's.
Oh, you're just waiting to hit that submit button, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, that's all.
And
okay.
Then I've recorded maybe like 10 or 15 other songs that I'm not even sure if I'll release them under Muted Circus or do another name.
Yeah, I remember that you had said that in your first episode, that you felt like that was a family-oriented term and that maybe it's time to retire it and move on to something else.
Yeah, so I haven't decided what... I guess in some ways I'm not sure if releasing the music feels that much different from not releasing the music, to get a little bit poetic.
Okay.
Like maybe you get it all mixed and mastered, but there's actually almost no difference between releasing it and not releasing it.
Mm.
Maybe that's a thing.
It's almost like you're saying like you wrote the music just for you and you alone, right?
Yeah, you could say that, but it's like, it's sort of like, I will release it, but I have to release it only when I really don't care if it's released or not.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough.
A little bit Buddhist, you know?
Right. A little bit. Yeah.
If you're trying to achieve something with your meditation, you're already kind of failed. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But so I have to overcome that. But then, I have a bunch of more music and I'll probably release it at some point. I have a lot of instrumental music too that I got to get around to releasing.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, I do appreciate y'all coming on and
hey, we really enjoyed it.
Big
I'll
thanks
for
George.
You.
George and I enjoyed
it. Yeah.
I'll give each of us email addresses and you can create great music that, you know, we can have a Benny and George compilation album or something. But I will.
Yeah, George, send me a note. Let's talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do. With pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I will add their website at the bottom of the description, and then y'all can visit them, buy their albums. Benny's and George's music is wonderful, and I think y'all would really have a great time listening to them.
Thanks
think
so much,
y'all,
James, for having us.
Thank you,
yes,
James.
Sir. Yes, sir.
Great service you do for artists. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. So until next time, y'all, everybody listening, thank you for listening. And always remember, when words fail, music speaks. Bye, guys.